on his belly. He felt it searching. He felt it finding. He felt it unbuttoning his trousers while her breathing filled the room. He pretended to read until he could not bear it any longer and had to move his body out of the way. She was dismayed, for the first thing they warned her about when they gave her the cleaning job was that she should not try to sleep with the clients. They did not have to tell her that, because she was one of those women who thought that prostitution did not mean going to bed for money, but going to bed with a stranger. She had two children, each by a different father, not because they were casual adventures, but because she could never love any man who came back after the third visit. Until that time, she had been a woman without a sense of urgency, a woman whose nature prepared her to wait without despair. But life in that house proved stronger than her virtue. She came to work at 6 in the afternoon, and she spent the whole night going through the rooms, sweeping them out, picking up condoms, changing the sheets. It was difficult to imagine the number of things that men left after love. They left vomit and tears, which seemed understandable to her. But they also left many enigmas of intimacy. Puddles of blood, patches of excrement, glass eyes, gold watches, false teeth, lockets with golden curls, love letters, business letters, condolence letters, all kinds of letters. Some came back for the items they had lost, but most were unclaimed, and Lothario Tugut kept them under lock and key and thought that sooner or later the palace that had seen better days with its thousands of forgotten belongings would become a museum of love. The work was hard and the pay was low, but she did it well. What she could not endure were the sobs, the laments, the creaking of the bedsprings, which filled her blood with so much ardor and so much sorrow that by dawn she could not bear the desire to go to bed with the first beggar she met on the street, with any miserable drunk who would give her what she wanted with no pretensions and no questions. The appearance of a man like Florentino Ariza, young, clean, and without a woman, was for her a gift from heaven, because from the first moment she realized that he was just like her, someone in need of love. But he was unaware of her compelling desire. He had kept his virginity for Fermina Daza, and there was no force or argument in this world that could turn him from his purpose. That was his life, 4 months before the date set for formalizing the engagement, when Lorenzo Daza showed up at the telegraph office one morning at 7 o'clock and asked for him. Since he had not yet arrived, Lorenzo Daza waited on the bench until 8:10, slipping a heavy gold ring with its noble opal stone from one finger to another, and as soon as Florentino Ariza came in, he recognized him as the employee who had delivered the telegram, and he took him by the arm.
"Come with me, my boy," he said. "You and I have to talk for 5 minutes, man to man."
Florentino Ariza, as green as a corpse, let himself be led. He was not prepared for this meeting, because Fermina Daza had not found either the occasion or the means to warn him. The fact was that on the previous Saturday, Sister Franca de la Luz, superior of the Academy of the Presentation of the Blessed Virgin, had come into the class on ideas of cosmogony with the stealth of a serpent, and spying on the students over their shoulders. She discovered that Fermina Daza was pretending to take notes in her notebook when in reality she was writing a love letter. According to the rules of the Academy, that error was reason for expulsion. Lorenzo Daza received an urgent summons to the rectory, where he discovered the leak through which his iron regime was trickling. Fermina Daza, with her innate fortitude, confessed to the error of the letter, but refused to reveal the identity of her secret sweetheart, and refused again before the tribunal of the order, which, therefore, confirmed the verdict of expulsion. Her father, however, searched her room, until then an inviolate sanctuary, and in the false bottom of her trunk, he found the packets of 3 years' worth of letters hidden away with as much love as had inspired their writing. The signature was unequivocal, but Lorenzo Daza could not believe, not then, not ever, that his daughter knew nothing about her secret lover except that he worked as a telegraph operator and that he loved the violin. Certain that such an intricate relationship was understandable only with the complicity of his sister, he did not grant her the grace of an excuse or the right of appeal, but shipped her on the schooner to San Juan de la Cienega. Fermina Daza never found relief from her last memory of her aunt on the afternoon when she said goodbye in the doorway, burning with fever inside her brown habit, bony and ashen, and then disappeared into the drizzle in the little park, carrying all that she owned in life. Her spinster's sleeping mat and enough money for a month wrapped in a handkerchief that she clutched in her fist. As soon as she had freed herself from her father's authority, Fermina Daza began a search for her in the Caribbean provinces, asking for information from everyone who might know her, and she could not find a trace of her until almost 30 years later, when she received a letter that had taken a long time to pass through many hands, informing her that she had died in the Water of God leprosarium. Lorenzo Daza did not foresee the ferocity with which his daughter would react to the unjust punishment of her aunt Escolastica, whom she had always identified with the mother she could barely remember. She locked herself in her room, refused to eat or drink, and when at last he persuaded her to open the door, first with threats and then with poorly dissimulated pleading, he found a wounded panther who would never be 15 years old again. He tried to seduce her with all kinds of flattery. He tried to make her understand that love at her age was an illusion. He tried to convince her to send back the letters and return to the academy and beg forgiveness on her knees, and he gave his word of honor that he would be the first to help her find happiness with a worthy suitor. But it was like talking to a corpse. Defeated, he at last lost his temper at lunch on Monday, and while he choked back insults and blasphemies and was about to explode, she put the meat knife to her throat, without dramatics, but with a steady hand and eyes so aghast that he did not dare to challenge her. That was when he took the risk of talking for 5 minutes, man to man, with the accursed upstart whom he did not remember ever having seen, and who had come into his life to his great sorrow. By force of habit, he picked up his revolver before he went out, but he was careful to hide it under his shirt. Florentino Ariza still had not recovered when Lorenzo Daza held him by the arm and steered him across the Plaza of the Cathedral to the arcaded gallery of the parish café and invited him to sit on the terrace. There were no other customers at that hour. A black woman was scrubbing the tiles in the enormous salon with its chipped and dusty stained glass windows, and the chairs were still upside down on the marble tables. Florentino Ariza had often seen Lorenzo Daza gambling and drinking cask wine there with the Asturians from the public market, while they shouted and argued about other long-standing wars that had nothing to do with our own. Conscious of the fatality of love, he had often wondered how the meeting would be that he was bound to have with Lorenzo Daza sooner or later, the meeting that no human power could forestall because it had been inscribed in both their destinies forever. He had supposed it would be an unequal dispute, not only because Fermina Daza had warned him in her letters of her father's stormy character, but because he himself had noted that his eyes seemed angry even when he was laughing at the gaming table. Everything about him was a testimony to crudeness. His ignoble belly, his emphatic speech, his lynx's side whiskers, his rough hands, the ring finger smothered by the opal setting. His only endearing trait, which Florentino Ariza recognized the first time he saw him walking, was that he had the same doe's gait as his daughter. However, when he showed him the chair so that he could sit down, he did not find Lorenzo Daza as harsh as he appeared to be, and his courage revived when he invited him to have a glass of anisette. Florentino Ariza had never had a drink at 8 o'clock in the morning, but he accepted with gratitude because his need for one was urgent. Lorenzo Daza, in fact, took no more than 5 minutes to say what he had to say, and he did so with a disarming sincerity that confounded Florentino Ariza. When his wife died, he had set only one goal for himself, to turn his daughter into a great lady. The road was long and uncertain for a mule trader who did not know how to read or write, and whose reputation as a horse thief was not so much proven as widespread in the province of San Juan de la Cienega. He lit a mule driver's cigar and lamented,
"The only thing worse than bad health is a bad name."
He said, however, that the real secret of his fortune was that none of his mules worked as hard and with so much determination as he did himself, even during the bitterest days of the wars when the villages awoke in ashes and the fields in ruins. Although his daughter was never aware of the premeditation in her destiny, she behaved as if she were an enthusiastic accomplice. She was intelligent and methodical, to the point where she taught her father to read as soon as she herself learned to, and at the age of 12, she had a mastery of reality that would have allowed her to run the house without the help of her aunt Escolástica. He sighed,
"She's a mule worth her weight in gold."
When his daughter finished primary school with highest marks in every subject and honorable mention at graduation, he understood that San Juan de la Cienega was too narrow for his dreams. Then he liquidated lands and animals and moved with new impetus and 70,000 gold pesos to this ruined city and its moth-eaten glories, where a beautiful woman with an old-fashioned upbringing still had the possibility of being reborn through a fortunate marriage. The sudden appearance of Florentino Ariza had been an unforeseen obstacle in his hard-fought plan.
"So I have come to make a request of you," said Lorenzo Daza.
He dipped the end of his cigar in the anisette, pulled on it and drew no smoke, then concluded in a sorrowful voice,
"Get out of our way."
Florentino Ariza had listened to him as he sipped his anisette, and was so absorbed in the disclosure of Fermina Daza's past that he did not even ask himself what he was going to say when it was his turn to speak. But when the moment arrived, he realized that anything he might say would compromise his destiny. "Have you spoken to her?" he asked.
"That doesn't concern you," said Lorenzo Daza.
"I ask you the question," said Florentino Ariza, "because it seems to me that she is the one who has to decide."
"None of that," said Lorenzo Daza. "This is a matter for men, and it will be decided by men."
His tone had become threatening, and a customer who had just sat down at a nearby table turned to look at them. Florentino Ariza spoke in a most tenuous voice, but with the most imperious resolution of which he was capable. "Be that as it may, I cannot answer without knowing what she thinks. It would be a betrayal." Then Lorenzo Daza leaned back in his chair, his eyelids reddened and damp, and his left eye spun in its orbit and stayed twisted toward the outside. He, too, lowered his voice.
"Don't force me to shoot you," he said.
Florentino Ariza felt his intestines filling with cold froth. But his voice did not tremble because he felt himself illuminated by the Holy Spirit. "Shoot me," he said with his hand on his chest. "There is no greater glory than to die for love." Lorenzo Daza had to look at him sideways like a parrot to see him with his twisted eye. He did not pronounce the four words so much as spit them out one by one.
"Son of a bitch!"
That same week, he took his daughter away on the journey that would make her forget. He gave her no explanation at all, but burst into her bedroom, his mustache stained with fury and his chewed cigar, and ordered her to pack. She asked him where they were going, and he answered,
"To our death."
Frightened by a response that seemed too close to the truth, she tried to face him with the courage of a few days before, but he took off his belt with its hammered copper buckle, twisted it around his fist and hit the table with a blow that resounded through the house like a rifle shot. Fermina Daza knew very well the extent and occasion of her own strength, and so she packed a bedroll with two straw mats and a hammock and two large trunks with all her clothes, certain that this was a trip from which she would never return. Before she dressed, she locked herself in the bathroom and wrote a brief farewell letter to Florentino Ariza on a sheet torn from the pack of toilet paper. Then she cut off her entire braid at the nape of her neck with cuticle scissors, rolled it inside a velvet box embroidered with gold thread, and sent it along with the letter. It was a demented trip. The first stage along the ridges of the Sierra Nevada, riding muleback in a caravan of Andean mule drivers, lasted 11 days, during which time they were stupefied by the naked sun or drenched by the horizontal October rains, and almost always petrified by the numbing vapors rising from the precipices. On the third day, a mule, maddened by gadflies, fell into a ravine with its rider, dragging along the entire line, and the screams of the man and his pack of 7 animals tied to one another continued to rebound along the cliffs and gullies for several hours after the disaster, and continued to resound for years and years in the memory of Fermina Daza. All her baggage plunged over the side with the mules. But in the centuries-long instant of the fall until the scream of terror was extinguished at the bottom, she did not think of the poor dead mule driver or his mangled pack, but of how unfortunate it was that the mule she was riding had not been tied to the others as well. It was the first time she had ever ridden, but the terror and unspeakable privations of the trip would not have seemed so bitter to her if it had not been for the certainty that she would never see Florentino Ariza again, or have the consolation of his letters. She had not said a word to her father since the beginning of the trip, and he was so confounded that he hardly spoke to her, even when it was an absolute necessity to do so, or he sent the mule drivers to her with messages. When the luck was good, they found some roadside inn that served rustic food, which she refused to eat, and rented them canvas cots stained with rancid perspiration and urine. But more often they spent the night in Indian settlements, in open-air public dormitories built at the side of the road, with their rows of wooden poles and roofs of bitter palm, where every passerby had the right to stay until dawn. Fermina Daza could not sleep through a single night as she sweated in fear and listened in the darkness to the coming and going of silent travelers who tied their animals to the poles and hung their hammocks where they could. At nightfall, when the first travelers would arrive, the place was uncrowded and peaceful. But by dawn, it had been transformed into a fairground, with a mass of hammocks hanging at different levels, and Arawak Indians from the mountains sleeping on their haunches, with the raging of the tethered goats and the uproar of the fighting cocks in their pharaonic crates, and the panting silence of the mountain dogs, who had been taught not to bark because of the dangers of war. Those privations were familiar to Lorenzo Daza, who had trafficked through the region for half his life and almost always met up with old friends at dawn. For his daughter, it was perpetual agony. The stench of the loads of salted catfish added to the loss of appetite caused by her grief, and eventually destroyed her habit of eating. And if she did not go mad with despair, it was because she always found relief in the memory of Florentino Ariza. She did not doubt that this was the land of forgetting. Another constant terror was the war. Since the start of the journey, there had been talk of the danger of running into scattered patrols, and the mule drivers had instructed them in the various ways of recognizing the two sides so that they could act accordingly. They often encountered squads of mounted soldiers under the command of an officer, who rounded up new recruits by roping them as if they were cattle on the hoof. Overwhelmed by so many horrors, Fermina Daza had forgotten about the one that seemed more legendary than imminent, until one night, when a patrol of unknown affiliation captured 2 travelers from the caravan and hanged them from a campano tree 1/2 league from the settlement. Lorenzo Daza did not even know them, but he had them taken down and he gave them a Christian burial in thanksgiving for not having met a similar fate. And he had reason. The assailants had awakened him with a rifle in his stomach, and a commander in rags, his face smeared with charcoal, had shone a light on him and asked him if he was liberal or conservative.
"Neither one nor the other," said Lorenzo Daza. "I am a Spanish subject." "What luck?" said the commander, and he left with his hand raised in a salute. "Long live the king!"
2 days later, they descended to the luminous plain where the joyful town of Valledupar was located. There were cockfights in the patios, accordion music on the street corners, riders on thoroughbred horses, rockets, and bells. A pyrotechnical castle was being assembled. Fermina Daza did not even notice the festivities. They stayed in the home of Uncle Lisímaco Sánchez, her mother's brother, who had come out to receive them on the King's Highway at the head of a noisy troop of young relatives riding the best-bred horses in the entire province, and they were led through the streets of the town to the accompaniment of exploding fireworks. The house was on the Grand Plaza next to the colonial church that had been repaired several times, and it seemed more like the main house on a hacienda because of its large, somber rooms and its gallery that faced an orchard of fruit trees and smelled of hot sugarcane juice. No sooner had they dismounted in the stables than the reception rooms were overflowing with numerous unknown relatives, whose unbearable effusiveness was a scourge to Fermina Daza, for she was incapable of ever loving anyone else in this world. She suffered from saddle burn. She was dying of fatigue and loose bowels, and all she longed for was a solitary and quiet place to cry. Her cousin, Hildebranda Sánchez, 2 years older than she and with the same imperial haughtiness, was the only one who understood her condition as soon as she saw her, because she too was being consumed in the fiery coals of reckless love. When it grew dark, she took her to the bedroom that she had prepared to share with her, and seeing the burning ulcers on her buttocks, she could not believe that she still lived. With the help of her mother, a very sweet woman who looked as much like her husband as if they were twins, she prepared a bath for her and cooled the burning with arnica compresses, while the thunder from the gunpowder castle shook the foundations of the house. At midnight, the visitors left, the public fiesta scattered into smoldering embers, and Cousin Hildebranda lent Fermina Daza a Matapalam nightgown and helped her to lie down in a bed with smooth sheets and feather pillows. And without warning, she was filled with the instantaneous panic of happiness. When at last they were alone in the bedroom, Cousin Hildebranda bolted the door with a crossbar and from under the straw matting of her bed took out a manila envelope sealed in wax with the emblem of the National Telegraph. It was enough for Fermina Daza to see her cousin's expression of radiant malice for the pensive scent of white gardenias to grow again in her heart's memory. And then she tore the red sealing wax with her teeth and drenched the 11 forbidden telegrams in a shower of tears until dawn. Then he knew. Before starting out on the journey, Lorenzo Daza had made the mistake of telegraphing the news to his brother-in-law, Lisímaco Sánchez. And he, in turn, had sent the news to his vast and intricate network of kinfolk in numerous towns and villages throughout the province. So that Florentino Ariza not only learned the complete itinerary, but also established an extensive brotherhood of telegraph operators who would follow the trail of Fermina Daza to the last settlement in Cabo de la Vela. This allowed him to maintain intensive communications with her from the time of her arrival in Valledupar, where she stayed 3 months, until the end of her journey in Riohacha, a year and a half later, when Lorenzo Daza took it for granted that his daughter had at last forgotten, and he decided to return home. Perhaps he was not even aware of how much he had relaxed his vigilance, distracted as he was by the flattering words of the in-laws, who, after so many years, had put aside their tribal prejudices and welcomed him with open arms as one of their own. The visit was a belated reconciliation, although that had not been its purpose. As a matter of fact, the family of Fermina Sanchez had been opposed in every way to her marrying an immigrant with no background, who was a braggart and a bore, and who was always traveling, trading his unbroken mules in a business that seemed too simple to be honest. Lorenzo Daza played for high stakes, because his sweetheart was the darling of a typical family of the region. An intricate tribe of wild women and soft-hearted men who were obsessed to the point of dementia with their sense of honor. Fermina Sanchez, however, settled on her desire with the blind determination of love when it is opposed, and she married him despite her family, with so much speed and so much secrecy that it seemed as if she had done so not for love, but to cover over with a sacramental cloak some premature mistake. 25 years later, Lorenzo Daza did not realize that his intransigence in his daughter's love affair was a vicious repetition of his own past. And he complained of his misfortune to the same in-laws who had opposed him, as they had complained in their day to their own kin. Still, the time he spent in lamentation was time his daughter gained for her love affair. So that while he went about castrating calves and taming mules on the prosperous lands of his in-laws, she was free to spend time with a troop of female cousins under the command of Ildebranda Sanchez, the most beautiful and obliging of them all, whose hopeless passion for a married man, a father who was 20 years older than she, had to be satisfied with furtive glances. After their prolonged stay in Valledupar, they continued their journey through the foothills of the mountains, crossing flowering meadows and dreamlike mesas, and in all the villages they were received as they had been in the first, with music and fireworks and new conspiratorial cousins and punctual messages in the telegraph offices. Fermina Daza soon realized that the afternoon of their arrival in Valledupar had not been unusual, but rather that in this fertile province, every day of the week was lived as if it were a holiday. The visitors slept wherever they happened to be at nightfall, and they ate wherever they happened to be hungry. For these were houses with open doors, where there was always a hammock hanging and a three-meat stew simmering on the stove, in case guests arrived before the telegram announcing their arrival, as was almost always the case. Ildebranda Sanchez accompanied her cousin for the remainder of the trip, guiding her with joyful spirit through the tangled complexities of her blood to the very source of her origins. Fermina Daza learned about herself. She felt free for the first time. She felt herself befriended and protected, her lungs full of the air of liberty, which restored her tranquility and her will to live. In her final years, she would still recall the trip that, with the perverse lucidity of nostalgia, became more and more recent in her memory. One night she came back from her daily walk, stunned by the revelation that one could be happy not only without love, but despite it. The revelation alarmed her, because one of her cousins had surprised her parents in conversation with Lorenzo Daza, who had suggested the idea of arranging the marriage of his daughter to the only heir to the fabulous fortune of Cleofas Moscote. Fermina Daza knew who he was. She had seen him in the plazas, pirouetting his perfect horses with trappings so rich they seemed ornaments used for the mass, and he was elegant and clever and had a dreamer's eyelashes that could make the stones sigh, but she compared him to her memory of poor, emaciated Florentino Arisa, sitting under the almond trees in the little park, with the book of verses on his lap, and she did not find even the shadow of a doubt in her heart. In those days, Ildebranda Sanchez was delirious with hope after visiting a fortune-teller whose clairvoyance had astonished her. Dismayed by her father's intentions, Fermina Daza also went to consult with her. The card said there was no obstacle in her future to a long and happy marriage. And that prediction gave her back her courage, because she could not conceive of such a fortunate destiny with any man other than the one she loved. Exalted by that certainty, she assumed command of her fate. That was how the telegraphic correspondence with Florentino Ariza stopped being a concerto of intentions and illusory promises, and became methodical and practical and more intense than ever. They set dates, established means, pledged their lives to their mutual determination to marry without consulting anyone, wherever and however they could, as soon as they were together again. Fermina Daza considered this commitment so binding that the night her father gave her permission to attend her first adult dance in the town of Fonseca, she did not think it was decent to accept without the consent of her fiancé. Florentino Ariza was in the transient hotel that night, playing cards with Lotario Tugut, when he was told he had an urgent telegram on the line. It was the telegraph operator from Fonseca, who had keyed in through 7 intermediate stations so that Fermina Daza could ask permission to attend the dance. When she obtained it, however, she was not satisfied with the simple affirmative answer, but asked for proof that in fact it was Florentino Ariza operating the telegraph key at the other end of the line. More astonished than flattered, he composed an identifying phrase. "Tell her that I swear by the crowned goddess." Fermina Daza recognized the password and stayed at her first adult dance until 7 in the morning, when she had to change in a rush in order not to be late for mass. By then she had more letters and telegrams in the bottom of her trunk than her father had taken away from her, and she had learned to behave with the air of a married woman. Lorenzo Daza interpreted these changes in her manner as proof that distance and time had cured her of her juvenile fantasies. But he never spoke to her about his plans for the arranged marriage. Their relations had become fluid within the formal reserve that she had imposed since the expulsion of Aunt Escolastica. And this allowed them such a comfortable modus vivendi that no one would have doubted that it was based on affection. It was at this time that Florentino Ariza decided to tell her in his letters of his determination to salvage the treasure of the sunken galleon for her. It was true, and it had come to him in a flash of inspiration one sunlit afternoon when the sea seemed paved with aluminum because of the numbers of fish brought to the surface by Mullen. All the birds of the air were in an uproar because of the kill, and the fishermen had to drive them away with their oars so they would not have to fight with them for the fruits of that prohibited miracle. The use of the Mullen plant to put the fish to sleep had been prohibited by law since colonial times, but it continued to be a common practice among the fishermen of the Caribbean until it was replaced by dynamite. One of Florentino Ariza's pastimes during Fermina Daza's journey was to watch from the jetties as the fishermen loaded their canoes with enormous nets filled with sleeping fish. At the same time, a gang of boys who swam like sharks asked curious bystanders to toss coins into the water so they could dive to the bottom for them. They were the same boys who swam out to meet the ocean liners for that purpose, and whose skill in the art of diving had been the subject of so many tourist accounts written in the United States and Europe. Florentino Ariza had always known about them, even before he knew about love, but it had never occurred to him that perhaps they might be able to bring up the fortune from the galleon. It occurred to him that afternoon, and from the following Sunday until Fermina Daza's return almost a year later, he had an additional motive for delirium. After talking to him for only 10 minutes, Euclides, one of the boy swimmers, became as excited as he was at the idea of an underwater exploration. Florentino Ariza did not reveal the whole truth of the enterprise, but he informed himself thoroughly regarding his abilities as a diver and navigator. He asked him if he could descend without air to a depth of 20 meters, and Euclides told him yes. He asked him if he was prepared to sail a fisherman's canoe by himself in the open sea in the middle of a storm with no instruments other than his instinct, and Euclides told him yes. He asked him if he could find a specific spot, 16 nautical miles to the northwest of the largest island in the Sotavento archipelago, and Euclides told him yes. He asked him if he was capable of navigating by the stars at night, and Euclides told him yes. He asked him if he was prepared to do so for the same wages the fishermen paid him for helping them to fish. And Euclides told him yes, but with an additional 5 reales on Sundays. He asked him if he knew how to defend himself against sharks, and Euclides told him yes, for he had magic tricks to frighten them away. He asked him if he was able to keep a secret, even if they put him in the torture chambers of the Inquisition, and Euclides told him yes. In fact, he did not say no to anything, and he knew how to say yes with so much conviction that there was no way to doubt him. Then the boy reckoned expenses. Renting the canoe, renting the canoe paddle, renting fishing equipment so that no one would suspect the truth behind their incursions. It was also necessary to take along food, a demijohn of fresh water, an oil lamp, a pack of tallow candles, and a hunter's horn to call for help in case of emergency. Euclides was about 12 years old, and he was fast and clever and an incessant talker, with an eel's body that could slither through a bull's eye. The weather had tanned his skin to such a degree that it was impossible to imagine his original color, and this made his big yellow eyes seem more radiant. Florentino Arisa decided on the spot that he was the perfect companion for an adventure of such magnitude, and they embarked without further delay the following Sunday. They sailed out of the fisherman's port at dawn, well-provisioned and better disposed. Euclides almost naked, with only the loincloth that he always wore, and Florentino Arisa, with his frock coat, his tenebrous hat, his patent leather boots, the poet's bow at his neck, and a book to pass the time during the crossing to the islands. From the very first Sunday, he realized that Euclides was as good a navigator as he was a diver, and that he had astonishing knowledge of the character of the sea and the debris in the bay. He could recount in the most unexpected detail the history of each rusting hulk of a boat. He knew the age of each buoy, the origin of every piece of rubbish, the number of links in the chain with which the Spaniards closed off the entrance of the bay. Fearing that he might also know the real purpose of his expedition, Florentino Arisa asked him sly questions, and in this way realized that Euclides did not have the slightest suspicion about the sunken galleon. Ever since he had first heard the story of the treasure in the transient hotel, Florentino Arisa had learned all he could about the habits of galleons. He learned that the San Jose was not the only ship in the coral depths. It was, in fact, the flagship of the Terra Firma fleet, and had arrived here after May 1708, having sailed from the legendary fair of Porto Bello in Panama, where it had taken on part of its fortune. 300 trunks of silver from Peru and Veracruz, and 110 trunks of pearls, gathered and counted on the island of Contadora. During the long month it had remained here, the days and nights had been devoted to popular fiestas, and the rest of the treasure intended to save the Kingdom of Spain from poverty had been taken aboard. 116 trunks of emeralds from Muso and Somondoco, and 30 million gold coins. The Terra Firma fleet was composed of no less than 12 supply ships of varying sizes, and it set sail from this port, traveling in a convoy with a French squadron that was heavily armed, but still incapable of protecting the expedition from the accurate cannon shot of the English squadron under Commander Charles Wager, who waited for it in the Sotavento Archipelago at the entrance to the bay. So the San Jose was not the only sunken vessel, although there was no reliable documented record of how many had succumbed and how many had managed to escape the English fire. What was certain was that the flagship had been among the first to sink, along with the entire crew and the commander standing straight on the quarterdeck, and that she alone carried most of the cargo. Florentino Arisa had learned the route of the galleons from the navigation charts of the period, and he thought he had determined the site of the shipwreck. They left the bay between the two fortresses of Boca Chica, and after 4 hours of sailing, they entered the interior still waters of the archipelago, in whose coral depths they could pick up sleeping lobsters with their hands. The air was so soft and the sea so calm and clear that Florentino Arisa felt as if he were his own reflection in the water. At the far end of the backwater, 2 hours from the largest island, was the site of the shipwreck. Suffocating in his formal clothes under the infernal sun, Florentino Arisa indicated to Euclides that he should try to dive to a depth of 20 meters and bring back anything he might find at the bottom. The water was so clear that he saw him moving below like a tarnished shark among the blue ones that crossed his path without touching him. Then he saw him disappear into a thicket of coral, and just when he thought that he could not possibly have any more air in his lungs, he heard his voice at his back. Euclides was standing on the bottom, with his arms raised and the water up to his waist. And so they continued exploring deeper sites, always moving toward the north, sailing over the indifferent manta rays, the timid squid, the rose bushes in the shadows, until Euclides concluded that they were wasting their time.
"If you don't tell me what you want me to find, I don't know how I'm going to find it," he said. But he did not tell him.
Then Euclides proposed to him that he take off his clothes and dive with him, even if it was only to see the other sky below the world, the coral depths. But Florentino Arisa always said that God had made the sea to look at through the window, and he had never learned to swim. A short while later, the afternoon grew cloudy and the air turned cold and damp, and it grew dark with so little warning that they had to navigate by the lighthouse to find the port. Before they entered the bay, the enormous white ocean liner from France passed very close to them, all its lights blazing as it trailed a wake of tender stew and boiled cauliflower. They wasted 3 Sundays in this way, and they would have continued to waste them all if Florentino Arisa had not decided to share his secret with Euclides, who then modified the entire search plan. And they sailed along the old channel of the galleons, more than 20 nautical leagues to the east of the spot Florentino Arisa had decided on. Less than 2 months had gone by when, one rainy afternoon out at sea, Euclides spent considerable time down on the bottom, and the canoe drifted so much that he had to swim almost half an hour to reach it, because Florentino Arisa could not row it closer to him. When at last he climbed on board, he took 2 pieces of woman's jewelry out of his mouth and displayed them as if they were the prize for his perseverance. What he recounted then was so fascinating that Florentino Arisa promised himself that he would learn to swim and dive as far underwater as possible, just so he could see it with his own eyes. He said that in that spot, only 18 meters down, there were so many old sailing ships lying among the coral reefs that it was impossible to even calculate the number, and they were spread over so extensive an area that you could not see to the end of them. He said that the most surprising thing was that none of the old wrecks afloat in the bay was in such good condition as the sunken vessels. He said that there were several caravels with their sails still intact, and that the sunken ships were visible even on the bottom, for it seemed as if they had sunk along with their own space and time, so that they were still illumined by the same 11 o'clock sun that was shining on Saturday, June 9th, when they went down. Choking on the driving force of his imagination, he said that the easiest one to distinguish was the galleon San Jose, for its name could be seen on the poop in gold letters, but it was also the ship most damaged by English artillery. He said he had seen an octopus inside, more than 3 centuries old, whose tentacles emerged through the openings in the cannon, and who had grown to such a size in the dining room that one would have to destroy the ship to free him. He said he had seen the body of the commander, dressed for battle and floating sideways inside the aquarium of the forecastle, and that if he had not dived down to the hold with all its treasure, it was because he did not have enough air in his lungs. There were the proofs. An emerald earring and a medal of the Virgin, the chain corroded by salt. That was when Florentino Arisa first mentioned the treasure to Fermina Daza, in a letter he sent to Fonseca a short while before her return. The history of the sunken galleon was familiar to her because she had heard it many times from Lorenzo Daza, who had lost both time and money
trying to convince a company of German divers to join with him in salvaging the sunken treasure. He would have persevered in the enterprise if several members of the Academy of History had not convinced him that the legend of the shipwrecked galleon had been invented by some brigand of a viceroy to hide his theft of the treasures of the crown. In any case, Fermina Daza knew that the galleon lay beyond the reach of any human being at a depth of 200 meters, not the 20 claimed by Florentino Arisa. But she was so accustomed to his poetic excesses that she celebrated the adventure of the galleon as one of his most successful. Still, when she continued to receive other letters with still more fantastic details, written with as much seriousness as his promises of love, she had to confess to Ildebranda Sanchez her fear that her bedazzled sweetheart must have lost his mind. During this time, Euclides had surfaced with so many proofs of his tale that it was no longer a question of playing with earrings and rings scattered amid the coral, but of financing a major enterprise to salvage the 50 ships with their cargo of Babylonian treasure. Then what had to happen sooner or later happened. Florentino Arisa asked his mother for help in bringing his adventure to a successful conclusion. All she had to do was bite the metal settings and look at the gems made of glass against the light to realize that someone was taking advantage of her son's innocence. Euclides went down on his knees and swore to Florentino Arisa that he had done nothing wrong, but he was not seen the following Sunday in the fisherman's port or anywhere else ever again. The only thing Florentino Arisa salvaged from that disaster was the loving shelter of the lighthouse. He had gone there in Euclides' canoe one night when a storm at sea took them by surprise, and from that time on, he would go there in the afternoons to talk to the lighthouse keeper about the innumerable marvels on land and water that the keeper had knowledge of. It was the beginning of a friendship that survived the many changes in the world. Florentino Arisa learned to feed the fire, first with loads of wood and then with large earthen jars of oil, before electrical energy came to us. He learned to direct the light and augment it with mirrors. And on several occasions when the lighthouse keeper could not do so, he stayed to keep watch over the night at sea from the tower. He learned to know the ships by their voices, by the size of their lights on the horizon, and to sense that something of them came back to him in the flashing beacon of the lighthouse. During the day, above all on Sundays, there was another kind of pleasure. In the district of the viceroys, where the wealthy people of the old city lived, the women's beaches were separated from those of the men by a plaster wall. One lay to the right and the other to the left of the lighthouse. And so the lighthouse keeper installed a spyglass, through which one could contemplate the women's beach by paying a centavo. Without knowing they were being observed, the young society ladies displayed themselves to the best of their ability in ruffled bathing suits and slippers and hats that hid their bodies almost as much as their street clothes did, and were less attractive besides. Their mothers, sitting out in the sun in wicker rocking chairs, wearing the same dresses, the same feathered hats, and holding the same organdy parasols as they had at high mass, watched over them from the shore, for fear the men from the neighboring beaches would seduce their daughters under the water. The reality was that one could not see anything more or anything more exciting through the spyglass than one could see on the street, but there were many clients who came every Sunday to wrangle over the telescope for the pure delight of tasting the insipid forbidden fruits of the walled area that was denied them. Florentino Arisa was one of them, more from boredom than for pleasure, but it was not because of that additional attraction that he became a good friend of the lighthouse keeper. The real reason was that after Fermina Daza rejected him, when he contracted the fever of many disparate loves in his effort to replace her, it was in the lighthouse and nowhere else that he lived his happiest hours and found the best consolation for his misfortunes. It was the place he loved most, so much so that for years he tried to convince his mother, and later his uncle Leo XII, to help him buy it. For in those days, the lighthouses in the Caribbean were private property,
and their owners charged ships according to their size for the right to enter the port. Florentino Ariza thought that it was the only honorable way to make a profit out of poetry, but neither his mother nor his uncle agreed with him, and by the time he had the resources to do it on his own, the lighthouses had become the property of the state. None of these dreams was in vain, however. The tale of the galleon and the novelty of the lighthouse helped to alleviate the absence of Fermin Adasa, and then, when he least expected it, he received the news of her return. And in fact, after a prolonged stay in Riohacha, Lorenzo Daza had decided to come home. It was not the most benign season on the ocean due to the December trade winds, and the historic schooner, the only one that would risk the crossing, might find itself blown by a contrary wind back to the port where it had started. And that is what happened. Fermina Daza spent an agonized night vomiting bile, strapped to her bunk in a cabin that resembled a tavern latrine, not only because of its oppressive narrowness, but also because of the pestilential stench and the heat. The motion was so strong that she had the impression several times that the straps on the bed would fly apart. On the deck, she heard fragments of shouted lamentations that sounded like a shipwreck, and her father's tigerish snoring in the next bunk added yet another ingredient to her terror. For the first time in almost 3 years, she spent an entire night awake without thinking for even one moment of Florentino Ariza, while he, on the other hand, lay sleepless in his hammock in the back room, counting the eternal minutes, one by one, until her return. At dawn, the wind suddenly died down, and the sea grew calm, and Fermina Daza realized that she had slept, despite her devastating seasickness, because the noise of the anchor chains awakened her. Then she loosened the straps and went to the porthole, hoping to see Florentino Ariza in the tumult of the port, but all she saw were the custom sheds among the palm trees gilded by the first rays of the sun and the rotting boards of the dock in Riohacha, where the schooner had set sail the night before. The rest of the day was like a hallucination. She was in the same house where she had been until yesterday, receiving the same visitors who had said goodbye to her, talking about the same things, bewildered by the impression that she was reliving a piece of life she had already lived. It was such a fateful repetition that Fermina Daza trembled at the thought that the schooner trip would be a repetition too, for the mere memory of it terrified her. However, the only other possible means of returning home was 2 weeks on muleback over the mountains, in circumstances even more dangerous than the first time, since a new civil war that had begun in the Andean state of Cauca was spreading throughout the Caribbean provinces. And so, at 8 o'clock that night, she was once again accompanied to the port by the same troop of noisy relatives, shedding the same tears of farewell and with the same jumble of last-minute gifts and packages that did not fit in the cabins. When it was time to sail, the men in the family saluted the schooner with a volley of shots fired into the air, and Lorenzo Daza responded from the deck with 5 shots from his revolver. Fermina Daza's fears dissipated, because the wind was favorable all night, and there was a scent of flowers at sea that helped her to sleep soundly without the safety straps. She dreamed that she was seeing Florentino Ariza again, and that he took off the face that she had always seen on him, because in fact it was a mask. But his real face was identical to the false one. She got up very early, intrigued by the enigma of the dream, and she found her father drinking mountain coffee with brandy in the captain's bar, his eye twisted by alcohol, but he did not show the slightest hint of uncertainty regarding their return. They were coming into port. The schooner slipped in silence through the labyrinth of sailing ships anchored in the cove of the public market, whose stench could be smelled several leagues out to sea, and the dawn was saturated by a steady drizzle that soon broke into a full-fledged downpour. Standing watch on the balcony of the telegraph office, Florentino Ariza recognized the schooner, its sails, disheartened by the rain, as it crossed Las Animas Bay and anchored at the market pier. The morning before, he had waited until 11 o'clock,
when he learned through a casual telegram of the contrary winds that had delayed the schooner. And on this day, he had returned to his vigil at 4 o'clock in the morning. He continued to wait, not taking his eyes off the launch that carried ashore the few passengers who had decided to disembark despite the storm. Halfway across, the launch ran aground, and most of them had to abandon ship and splash through the mud to the pier. At 8 o'clock, after they had waited in vain for the rain to stop, a black stevedore in water up to his waist received Fermina Daza at the rail of the schooner and carried her ashore in his arms, but she was so drenched that Florentino Ariza did not recognize her. She herself was not aware of how much she had matured during the trip until she walked into her closed house and at once undertook the heroic task of making it livable again with the help of Gala Placidia, the black servant, who came back from her old slave quarters as soon as she was told of their return. Fermina Daza was no longer the only child, both spoiled and tyrannized by her father, but the lady and mistress of an empire of dust and cobwebs that could be saved only by the strength of invincible love. She was not intimidated, because she felt herself inspired by an exalted courage that would have enabled her to move the world. The very night of their return, while they were having hot chocolate and crullers at the large kitchen table, her father delegated to her the authority to run the house, and he did so with as much formality as if it were a sacred rite.
"I turn over to you the keys to your life," he said.
She, with all of her 17 years behind her, accepted with a firm hand, conscious that every inch of liberty she won was for the sake of love. The next day, after a night of bad dreams, she suffered her first sense of displeasure at being home when she opened the balcony window and saw again the sad drizzle in the little park, the statue of the decapitated hero, the marble bench where Florentino Ariza used to sit with his book of verses. She no longer thought of him as the impossible sweetheart, but as the certain husband to whom she belonged heart and soul. She felt the heavy weight of the time they had lost while she was away. She felt how hard it was to be alive, and how much love she was going to need to love her man as God demanded. She was surprised that he was not in the little park, as he had been so many times despite the rain, and that she had received no sign of any kind from him, not even a premonition. And she was shaken by the sudden idea that he had died. But she put aside the evil thought at once, for in the recent frenzy of telegrams regarding her imminent return, they had forgotten to agree on a way to continue communicating once she was home. The truth is that Florentino Ariza was sure she had not returned until the telegraph operator in Riohacha confirmed that they had embarked on Friday, aboard the very same schooner that did not arrive the day before because of contrary winds, so that during the weekend he watched for any sign of life in her house, and at dusk on Monday he saw through the windows a light that moved through the house and was extinguished, a little after 9, in the bedroom with the balcony. He did not sleep, victim to the same fearful nausea that had disturbed his first nights of love. Tránsito Ariza arose with the first roosters, alarmed that her son had gone out to the patio at midnight and had not yet come back inside, and she did not find him in the house. He had gone to wander along the jetties, reciting love poetry into the wind and crying with joy until daybreak. At 8 o'clock he was sitting under the arches of the parish café, delirious with fatigue, trying to think of how to send his welcome to Fermina Daza, when he felt himself shaken by a seismic tremor that tore his heart. It was she, crossing the plaza of the cathedral, accompanied by Gala Placidia, who was carrying the baskets for their marketing, and for the first time, she was not wearing her school uniform. She was taller than when she had left, more polished and intense, her beauty purified by the restraint of maturity. Her braid had grown in, but instead of letting it hang down her back, she wore it twisted over her left shoulder, and that simple change had erased all girlish traces from her. Florentino Ariza sat bedazzled until the child of his vision had crossed the plaza, looking to neither the left nor the right. But then the same irresistible power that had paralyzed him obliged him to hurry after her when she turned the corner of the cathedral and was lost in the deafening noise of the market's rough cobblestones. He followed her without letting himself be seen, watching the ordinary gestures, the grace, the premature maturity of the being he loved most in the world, and whom he was seeing for the first time in her natural state. He was amazed by the fluidity with which she made her way through the crowd. While Galla Placidia bumped into people and became entangled in her baskets and had to run to keep up with her, she navigated the disorder of the street in her own time and space, not colliding with anyone, like a bat in the darkness. She had often been to the market with her aunt Escolastica, but they made only minor purchases, since her father himself took charge of provisioning the household, not only with furniture and food, but even with women's clothing. So this first excursion was for her a fascinating adventure idealized in her girlhood dreams. She paid no attention to the urgings of the snake charmers who offered her a syrup for eternal love, or to the pleas of the beggars lying in doorways with their running sores, or to the false Indian who tried to sell her a trained alligator. She made a long and detailed tour with no planned itinerary, stopping with no other motive than her unhurried delight in the spirit of things. She entered every doorway where there was something for sale, and everywhere she found something that increased her desire to live. She relished the aroma of vetiver in the cloth in the great chests. She wrapped herself in embossed silks. She laughed at her own laughter when she saw herself in the full-length mirror in the golden wire, disguised as a woman from Madrid, with a comb in her hair and a fan painted with flowers. In the store that sold imported foods, she lifted the lid of a barrel of pickled herring that reminded her of nights in the Northeast when she was a very little girl in San Juan de la Cienega. She sampled an Alicante sausage that tasted of licorice, and she bought two for Saturday's breakfast, as well as some slices of cod and a jar of red currants in aguardiente. In the spice shop, she crushed leaves of sage and oregano in the palms of her hands for the pure pleasure of smelling them, and bought a handful of cloves, another of star anise, and one each of ginger root and juniper. And she walked away with tears of laughter in her eyes, because the smell of the cayenne pepper made her sneeze so much. In the French cosmetics shop, as she was buying Reuter soaps and balsam water, they put a touch of the latest perfume from Paris behind her ear and gave her a breath tablet to use after smoking. She played at buying, it is true, but what she really needed she bought without hesitation, with an authority that allowed no one to think that she was doing so for the first time. For she was conscious that she was buying not only for herself, but for him as well. 12 yards of linen for their table, percale for the marriage sheets that by dawn would be damp with moisture from both their bodies, the most exquisite of everything for both of them to enjoy in the house of love. She asked for discounts, and she got them. She argued with grace and dignity until she obtained the best, and she paid with pieces of gold that the shopkeepers tested for the sheer pleasure of hearing them sing against the marble counters. Florentino Ariza spied on her in astonishment. He pursued her breathlessly. He tripped several times over the baskets of the maid, who responded to his excuses with a smile, and she passed so close to him that he could smell her scent. And if she did not see him, then it was not because she could not, but because of the haughty manner in which she walked. To him, she seemed so beautiful, so seductive, so different from ordinary people, that he could not understand why no one was as disturbed as he by the clicking of her heels on the paving stones, why no one else's heart was wild with the breeze stirred by the sighs of her veils, why everyone did not go mad with the movements of her braid, the flight of her hands, the gold of her laughter. He had not missed a single one of her gestures, not one of the indications of her character, but he did not dare approach her for fear of destroying the spell. Nevertheless, When she entered the riotous noise of the arcade of the scribes, he realized that he might lose the moment he had craved for so many years. Fermina Daza shared with her schoolmates the singular idea that the arcade of the scribes was a place of perdition that was forbidden, of course, to decent young ladies. It was an arcaded gallery across from a little plaza, where carriages and freight carts drawn by donkeys were for hire, where popular commerce became noisier and more dense. The name dated from colonial times, when the taciturn scribes in their vests and false cuffs first began to sit there, waiting for a poor man's fee to write all kinds of documents. Memoranda of complaints or petition, legal testimony, cards of congratulation or condolence, love letters appropriate to any stage in an affair. They, of course, were not the ones who had given that thundering market its bad reputation, but more recent peddlers who made illegal sales of all kinds of questionable merchandise smuggled in on European ships, from obscene postcards and aphrodisiac ointments to the famous Catalonian condoms with iguana crests that fluttered when circumstances required, or with flowers at the tip that would open their petals at the will of the user. Fermina Daza, somewhat unskilled in the customs of the street, went through the arcade without noticing where she was going as she searched for a shady refuge from the fierce 11 o'clock sun. She sank into the hot clamor of the shoeshine boys and the bird sellers, the hawkers of cheap books and the witch doctors and the sellers of sweets who shouted over the din of the crowd, "Pineapple sweets for your sweetie. Coconut candy is dandy. Brown sugar loaf for your sugar." But indifferent to the uproar, she was captivated on the spot by a paper seller who was demonstrating magic inks, red inks with an ambience of blood, inks of sad aspect for messages of condolence, phosphorescent inks for reading in the dark, invisible inks that reveal themselves in the light. She wanted all of them, so she could amuse Florentino Ariza and astound him with her wit. But after several trials, she decided on a bottle of gold ink. Then she went to the candy sellers, sitting behind their big round jars,